We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 344. Senator Yee.
Good afternoon.
Thank you, Senator, for coming.
Thank you for calling on me. I have to go back to a hearing another committee. For the record, I'm State Senator May Yee, representing Senate District 19, which is comprised of portions of Lynn and Benton counties, and thank you for this opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 344A enclosed. In response to the Thurston School violence last May, I sponsored Senate Bill 555, which proposed that a student found in possession of a firearm be detained and that a mental health evaluation be conducted before release to the family. The family would be responsible for the cost of evaluation, except in cases of hardship. I'm glad that most of Senate Bill 555 was incorporated into Senate Bill 344, except for the payment of the evaluation by parents. I'm submitting herewith an amendment to add the provision I had in Senate Bill 555 that will hold the parents responsible for the cost if the court orders a mental health evaluation. On page 5, line 4 of Senate Bill 344, after screening of the youth, I would request that you consider adding my amendment for the parents to pay the cost. In talking with people in my district, they believe that parents should be responsible both for their children's behavior and for the consequences and costs involved, except for cases of extreme hardship. The school districts have indicated to me they have no funding for the cost of the evaluation. Whether we talk about prevention of school violence or treatment of problem youth, we need to involve parents early on in order to be effective. The Senate Judiciary Committee is supportive of my request for your consideration of adding this provision. Your favorable consideration would be appreciated.
And Senator, just for the committee's sake, about the approximate cost of this health assessment that you're referring to?
I understand is about $500.
Okay, so, and then the next question would be, who would decide if a case is an extreme hardship? Would it be the court?
The court.
The court would make the decision?
Yes.
Other questions for Senator Yee? Representative Hobson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Yee. Was there discussion or have you looked into the factor if the parent is unwilling or unable to pay, who takes care of this bill or how is the money received from the family?
Well, I understand that the taxpayers will have to pay. So that means juvenile department will have to come in with some money, or the youth authority will have to pay for the evaluation. But I don't know how
the money would come from the court's budget, not from the district attorney's budget, nor from the school budget. But the cost of the assessment would be at the cost of the court. From their budget.
Or is it possible to come from the juvenile department of that area?
Actually, I was informed this morning from Multnomah County DA that it would come from the court's budget. And there is a possibility that we could ask for some existing money from the juvenile justice plan that the governor already has to direct some of that money to the court for this. Whether that would happen or not, I don't know. But that's who would have to pay for it at this point. So your amendments are probably would be welcome to the court in requiring the parents to pay for it if they can.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Senator, would you have a problem with adding into your amendments the idea that a determination for the parents to also have some kind of an evaluation if they've got a child that brings a gun to school or is involved in the things that we're talking about here?
Mr. Chairman, are you saying mental health evaluation of the parents?
Actually, a family evaluation is what was suggested.
Oh, I see.
This morning.
Mm-hmm.
There may be some problems that the parents are having as well that are contributing to the child's problems.
Yes. I have no problem with that, if that's what the court determines the right thing to do.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Further questions? Thank you, Senator.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We'll have the committee administrator send a note to your office when we do the work session on this bill.
I would appreciate that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We will recess our hearing on Senate Bill 344 and Mr. Bassett, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 868, Mr. Bassett.
And Mr. Kearns.
Oh, and Mr. Kearns.
Oh, this is 344, that's right.
Kearns, Sensary, and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Roger Bassett, Commissioner for the Office of Community College Services and Job Training Partnership Act. The knower of all things legislative for the state system of higher ed.
The former honorable.
I appreciate the courtesy, Mr. Chair, of moving this up. What we have in Senate Bill 868 as passed by the Senate and sent to you is a statutory language necessary to make the regional partnerships between Oregon University System institutions and community colleges work. I think you're aware that the two boards, the Board of Education and the Board of Higher Education, are working together as the joint boards of education on a number of things, including these three partnerships. They include Eastern Oregon University with Blue Mountain and Treasure Valley, Southern Oregon University with Rogue, and OIT with Klamath. Funding for this is part of the current service level budget of our agency. It's been passed by both sides of the House, but among the breakthrough ideas here are incentives that encourage students to do, so far, one of two things. One, take lower division courses, community college students take lower division courses at the four-year institution, usually near enough by to do that, so that the community college doesn't have to duplicate the same courses. So what we do is allow the funds in this partnership to forgive the difference between university system and community college tuition in order for community college lower division students to just simply enroll in the course at the university or at OIT. Some are proposing we do something similar with transfer students, so it would become a 2+2 arrangement within higher education, so that the difference for students in a particular track, like teacher education in Eastern Oregon, for example, or technical baccalaureate degrees available at OIT is another example. Students who have completed their community college experience might be forgiven the difference in tuition as an incentive to continue on. In both cases, there is language in the Oregon University System statute that cautions against the use of general fund for anything that might be called a student scholarship. It's against the risk someone might call this that. We ask for this legislation making it clear that should the board, in their effort to find ways to share facilities and programs and enrollments, should they choose to use some of these funds for such an incentive, that they would not run afoul of that restriction.
And you both like this?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Grant Kearns, representing the Oregon University System, and actually taking the part of Vice Chancellor Diane Bynes, who is Secretary to the Board and our coordinator for the State Board. I'm not able to be here today. Yes, both like it. The impact is to make the tuition differential between community college and the Oregon University System transparent to the student, so that the differential does not become a barrier to continuation or even enrollment. And it is the buy down of the tuition differential between the two that could run afoul of someone saying that is a scholarship when it is when it's not. And so this language cures that. It also codifies what state boards are doing now relative to their joint meetings and their policy coordination, and is a good bill.
Questions? I have not polled the committee on this issue. we will move into a work session on Senate Bill 868. Representative Winters.
I move Senate Bill 868 as amended to the floor with the dissent.
Representative Winters moves Senate Bill 868 engrossed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Do any of the members have any other questions that you'd like to ask of the... No discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Can we send it back? Can we send it close?
She's excused.
Can we send it Hopkins?
Yes.
Aye.
Can we send it Cano?
Aye.
Can we send it Morissette?
Aye.
Can we send it Starr?
Aye.
Can we send it Wilson?
Aye.
Can we send it Richards?
Aye.
Here's the Ferry?
What's aye? Motion is passed. Representative Knope, would you like to carry this bill?
Yes, sir. I'd be happy to.
Okay. We will reconvene in the public hearing on Senate Bill 344. Kathy Osborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Osborne from the Juvenile Rights Project. We are in support of Senate Bill 344 in its current form. I committee know that there was a work group that was convened when this bill was over on the Senate side that was had pretty much all of the stakeholders involved in it, and this bill came out as a going through that process. If I can address, I was out of the room briefly when Senator Yee was speaking, but I think there were some questions about evaluations and who could pay for them. Currently, the whoever requests the evaluation in juvenile court or in any court actually is the party that pays for those evaluations. The juvenile court does have the authority to require that parents pay for them, I would think, perhaps, pursuant to 419C.020, which says that the obligation of the parents is to pay for compensation or reasonable expenses for counsel, support of the child while the child is in custody, and any other obligations to pay money that may arise as a result of the child being within the jurisdiction of the court. However, for that to come about, the child would have to be found within the jurisdiction of the court where the parents could be required to pay this, and there could be some arguments that they would only have to pay for it if it resulted after the child was found within the jurisdiction of the court. The reality of the matter is pre-adjudication, what often happens is a judge will order a juvenile department to have an evaluation, a more thorough evaluation done if the court feels there needs to be a more thorough evaluation. The problem pre-adjudication is that the child's attorney will often not allow the child to take part in that evaluation. The reason being is because any psychologist will tell you the first question that's going to be asked in that psychological evaluation is, why did you bring a gun to school? And since there is no confidentiality afforded to that child from a evaluator who is being paid for by the state or by the county juvenile department, any statements that child makes to that evaluator could be used against that child in an adjudication process. So what often happens is in juvenile court for evaluations is that no evaluation is done, no specific evaluation is done of the child in terms of a psychological evaluation until after the adjudication prior to disposition, which is why in this bill we put it as a mental health assessment. A mental health assessment is different from a psychological evaluation, and a mental health assessment can actually get you much of the information that the court needs to know about whether releasing this child would cause the child to be a danger to the community. I know in Multnomah County actually does mental health assessments on every child that's held in detention. Reason being is a mental health assessment, one of the things that a mental health assessment will show you is whether that youth is suicidal or not. And certainly Multnomah County, I know, and probably most other counties that have youth in a detention facility want to know if that youth is going to require be on suicide watch while the youth is in custody for obvious liability concerns. So that's why the bill now has just that the court can order mental health assessments. Now the court has the ability to order a full-blown psych eval prior to adjudication. And I have certainly, in my 9 years of representing juveniles charged with delinquent acts, have often come to agreements with the state that a psychological evaluation would be done of my client. Anything that my client said during that psychological evaluation would not be used against my client. We would just get the results from the psychologist, and then the psychologist, prior to adjudication, then after adjudication, the psychologist would give us the full report, which would include any statements that my client made pre-adjudication about the actual incident. The ability to do that is going to depend on the agreement of whether the state's going to be willing to make those agreements with the defense attorneys prior to the adjudication. The other thing I want to point out is this: I think this legislation does a good job at making sure that kids that bring guns to school are not released automatically and are treated very carefully. I would tell you, however, that everything that's in this bill, the juvenile departments and the police already have the authority to do. What we're trying to do here is spell it out a little bit, perhaps more concretely, that there is that authority to do this. But they already have the authority to hold juveniles who are brought in on firearms charges. They already had the ability to make sure that those kids are held in detention. And they already had the ability to order any evaluations. I would urge this committee to question, in terms of any kind of mandatory hold, that I would let them know that Multnomah County right now has a risk assessment instrument. They run every child through, which actually, then if you score over a 9, if you're presumptively going to be held between a 9 and a 12, they have somebody else look at the score sheet, but a 12, you're definitely held. It's hard to really explain without having the sheet in front of you. After the Thurston High School incident, what Multnomah County did is take all of the firearms kids that were brought in for any reason carrying a firearm, not just at school, they took those kids out of even going through the risk assessment instrument. It was an automatic hold on those kids until the next a judge could decide whether or not they should be released or not. What they found is that all of the children that the Ray instrument would have released were released by the judge. All of the children that the Ray instrument would not release were not released by the judge. So what we are seeing in Multnomah County is that this Ray instrument, this risk assessment instrument, that's what Ray stands for, was actually doing a very good job at telling us which children should be held and which children should not be held. Kind of as a side note, this instrument was designed to try to reduce the minority overrepresentation in Multnomah County in detention. It's done an excellent job at doing that, but it also seems to be doing a very good job at predicting which kids need to be held and which kids should not be held. And if this committee has, wants to make any kind of recommendations, certainly it seems that more counties should be using an instrument such as the Ray instrument to help us determine which children are a danger to society and should not be released and which children are not. But we are in favor of this bill. I think it's a good mix between making sure these kids are dealt with and looked at by the judges and giving the police the authority to the knowledge that they actually could hold these children. And it also, I think, helps to set forth what's going to happen when these children do come before the judge. I'm available.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said everything that this bill does can be done now.
That's correct. Chair Senator Johnson, everything that's in this bill can be done now.
What's the magic in this bill, then, that we'll get it done?
Chair Senator, Representative Jensen, I think the magic in this bill is it takes the decision-making point from the police to the judge. It changes the decision-making point from the police officer, who has the authority to hold any of these children who are caught with guns in the school. It takes that decision-making point from the police officer and puts it in the hands of the judge. What I've heard throughout this process is there were police officers who, let me go back. The presumption is in the juvenile code is if you have a parent that this child could be released to, you should release the child to the parent. That's the presumption in the juvenile code for the police in terms of releasing. Just because there's a parent, however, doesn't mean they have to release it to the parent. It's just there's a presumption that they should. What I think this bill does is that for those children that have brought a gun to school, it changes that decision-making point from the police officer to a judge so that the judge is deciding whether or not to release the child to those parents, not the police officer. The police officer has a black-white rule, essentially. If the kid has a gun in school, the police officer shall arrest, and the police officer shall take that child to detention. And what happens, what the juvenile justice system does to the child afterwards is up to the juvenile justice system.
Just a question or concern. Right now in this building, we're looking at budgets for the judicial area. And at least in my district, they're very stressed for time and resources. Is this bill going to put more on them that could be done at the present time by someone else?
Chair Senator, Representative Jensen, I don't believe that it is because of the changes that we made in the bill. There's no extended mandatory hold, which would really tax the system of the juvenile departments who don't have detention facilities in their county and rent them from another county. That would really tax their ability, their resources, and so that's why that is not in. And the other reason that's the other reason why the mandatory psych evals are not in. Again, I've been representing juveniles that have been charged with delinquent acts for 9 years, and let me assure you, and some of those kids have brought guns or other weapons to school, and let me assure you, the most seriously mentally ill children that I've dealt with were not the kids that brought the guns to school. So we certainly don't want to be forcing juvenile departments to be spending resources doing mandatory evaluations on kids that are bringing guns to school when there may be other kids out there where those services are needed more because they really need to know how dangerous this child is. And the kid that brings the gun to school, they can do a quick assessment of the child and determine that this isn't a child that we really have to be that concerned about.
Thank you.
Thanks for that great explanation. I guess my question is, what's the usual length of time for a judge to hear the case? Now, again, in John Day, Oregon, on a Friday afternoon, will a judge be available to make that determination before Monday or whatever?
Chair Senator, Vice Chair Morissette. Statutorily, a decision has to be made on whether to continue to hold a child in detention within 36 hours, not including weekends or legal holidays. So even if in John Day, Oregon, if there's not a judge on a Friday afternoon that can hear the case before Monday, they would still be within their statutory time limit of when they would have the detention hearing. We didn't change that 36 hours, but they have to have that initial detention hearing.
Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kathy, had, what effect would this statute that was, this bill that we're dealing with now would have had on the Thurston incident if it had been in existence?
Sure, Senator Representative Winters, the effect that it would have had in the whole, and this was certainly the driving force behind this, this legislation, is my understanding, is my understanding is the youth that was involved in that incident allegedly was allegedly arrested for having a gun in school the day before. If that is correct, what would have happened is that youth would have been held and would not have been released to the parents. My understanding is that youth was released to the parents by the police officer following legal, I mean, he was legally correct in his decision based on the juvenile code. And I certainly would hate to be in that that person's shoes now. But they were legal, he was legally correct in his decision. However, what this legislation would have done is take that decision out of his hands and put it in the hands of a juvenile judge the prior day. Would have had any effect on the ultimate outcome? We don't know, because we don't know what would have happened in that 24 hours or 48 or 36 hours between the time that the child was originally arrested and when that detention hearing would have occurred. That's the unknown.
Currently under the adult statutes, if there is view that a person is a danger to himself or the community, you can hold those individuals for 72 hours, if that's correct, I believe.
Chair Sinisteri, Representative Winters, there is a process for adults to be held civilly for 72 hours if they're found to be a danger to themselves or others, and that's more of a through a civil commitment, not exactly through the criminal statutes. There is also an ability to hold a child for 72 hours, again, through a more civil-type commitment, although that usually goes through the juvenile court and not through, just as the delinquency case does, and not through the civil commitment court as the adult would. My knowledge about this can only be based in terms of Multnomah County, where the spaces in the psychiatric, in the secure psychiatric wards are very limited, and it's extremely difficult to have a child held for 72 hours on in the psychiatric hold. It pretty much will take a serious suicide attempt to get a child held for that, or a psychotic break.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. I'd like to ask you about the development of probable cause, especially in that this bill delivers some retroactivity there. If you could explain that, I'd appreciate it.
I'll certainly try. Chair Sinisteri, Representative Wilson. Right now, a police officer needs, as you all may know, probable cause in order to arrest without a warrant. What this bill does not change that. Basically, what this bill says is that if a school employee sees or gets information that a child has a gun in school, they must report it to the school. It's limited in time only because there was certainly an argument that if this bill passes and a teacher knew that 2 years ago a student had a gun in school, we didn't really want that student automatically reported, and we didn't really want that student automatically arrested and go through that process, because the danger to the community was probably not as severe as it would be if it was an immediate circumstance. In order for there's a requirement that the police officer essentially hold on to the child. If the police officer comes to the school and the child's in the principal's office, the police officer's not to release the child and say, okay, you go while we investigate this and I may go and arrest you later. The idea is they're to hold on to that child if they have the child until they determine whether they have probable cause to arrest or not. We're not changing that standard. Basically, what we are, the one change that's being made, other than the reporting change, is police officers, hold on to this kid. Don't let them go. I think that in terms of the investigation, whether the police officer actually does hold on to the child is going to depend upon the timeline. In other words, if there's a report that a child 3 weeks ago brought a gun to school and the child is not immediately in front of the police officer, I think the police officer is probably going to do the investigation first, determine whether they have probable cause, and then go arrest the child, actually technically take the child into protective custody since we don't arrest children.
Thank you.
Thank you. To be sure that I understand the discretion or the change in what the police officer is required to do, how would this bill carry out if in October a student brought a hunting rifle to school in the back gun rack of his pickup?
Chair Sinceri, Representative Hobson. Right now, having an unloaded rifle in a gun rack in your pickup at school is not a crime. If it's properly, if it's dealt with properly, this would not change that. What it would do, if I'm going back to what I think your question was, in terms of if 6 months ago we find out that this kid had a, or in October we found out that this kid had the hunting rifle, what I would expect would happen is the police would investigate the circumstances surrounding that and make a determination of whether this is a case that needed to, if they had probable cause to arrest. The problem with probable cause is obviously the more time there is between the report of the incident and the actual incident, the harder it's going to be for the police to determine whether there was probable cause.
Representative Marshall.
Thank you. I understand that various school districts around the state have the option of allowing rifles to be put in the backs of trucks, but I know Pleasant Hill High School has that. So it isn't a matter of having to go back and figure probable cause. I mean, you would first check with the district, I would imagine, to see if they do allow that. And there are other circumstances, I think, where guns can be brought onto campus for safety courses and so on.
Chair Sinceri, Vice Chair Morissette, that's correct. And we were trying to be very careful to make sure that that did not change, especially because of the ROTC classes, the hunter safety classes, the classes where kids will actually bring the guns into school to work on in shop class or woodworking class. Those classes and those situations were all brought to our attention during the work group, and we were trying very hard to make sure that those activities would still be able to go on without those children becoming all of a sudden the subject of a police investigation.
Larry Oglesby, Rick Hill, and Mike Livingston.
Chair, members of the committee, Rick Hill, Director of the Oregon Youth Authority. The Youth Authority introduced Senate Bill 344 at the request of Governor Kitzhaber in response to the Thurston High School shootings last year in Springfield, Oregon. The purpose of this bill is to simply establish in law a course of action to be followed when a gun or device is discovered in school or at a school-related event. As has already been mentioned by Kathy Osborne and Senator Yee, a group of juvenile justice professionals got together and put this bill together last year. That group included a couple of district attorneys, Dale Penn from Marion County and Mike Dugan from Deschutes County. We had Chief DeForest of the Springfield Police Department. We had folks from the Lane County Juvenile Department, the Oregon State Police, the Oregon Sheriff's Association, as well as Kathy Osborne from the Juvenile Rights Project and Ingrid Swenson from the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. So we've had quite a group of people working on this. We managed to get it through the Senate. It's actually an approved bill now with the amendments than it was when we first launched it. So what we have for you today is testimony from Michael Livingston from the Attorney General's office, who really was the author of the bill and put it together and has put before you today a summary that highlights the 7 or 8 parts of this bill that make it, I think in response to Representative Jensen's question, what is it, why do we need this bill if we can do everything today without it? I think Michael's testimony and his summary explains that to you very well.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Livingston. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Appellate Division of the Department of Justice. In my work as a lawyer for the Department of Justice, I've done quite a bit of work in the juvenile law area. I was a member of the task force chaired by then Mayor Morissette and the mayor of Eugene following the Thurston High School shooting. I'd like to begin a little bit out of the regular order, if I might, to respond to a question Representative Hobson raised, which I think is an appropriate one and one that may clear up some misunderstanding. There are three weapons offenses that are covered by the reporting requirement and by the mandatory custody requirement. They are ORS 166-250, which is the unlawful possession of a firearm, ORS 166-370, which defines the crime of possession of a firearm or destructive device in a public building, and ORS 166-382, which defines the offense of possession of unlawful possession of a destructive device. Senate Bill 344 makes no changes in the substantive law of those offenses, with one exception, and that is it expands the definition of school for purposes of a public building to include not only the school building itself and the adjacent ground, but any off-site activity that the school sponsors. For example, my son goes to South Salem High School. They had their prom in the Reed Opera House ballroom on the third floor. Under this bill, that would be a school for purposes of 344. And the reason I address that to your concern, I think there may be a misunderstanding that somehow this bill makes unlawful what is now lawful in terms of possession of a firearm. It does not. All the lawful activities in public buildings that can be carried on with a firearm continue to be lawful under this bill. Again, the only change is to expand what the definition of a school is. There are three main components of the bill, and in the outline of, in the testimony that I've submitted today, I give you a breakdown of what the components are and also where applicable what the current law is. And those three main parts are this: the reporting requirement, which is modeled after the child abuse reporting law in Chapter 419B, which makes it mandatory for school employees to report when they have reasonable grounds to believe. And then that's, of course, followed up with a prompt investigation by law enforcement. That's part one. And there's no counterpart under existing law now. Part two is when an officer has probable cause, that means it's more likely than not that this person has committed one of these offenses, then the officer must detain that juvenile. And that's the biggest change this bill makes in current law. The example in the Springfield Thurston High shootings, the current law then was and is now that if an officer takes a juvenile into custody, unless the officer has probable cause to believe that the juvenile is an immediate threat, then the juvenile must be released to the parent or the guardian. And in the Thurston case, that law put the officers in a rather difficult and untenable position. They might have suspected for very reasonable reasons that this young man should not be released, but in effect, the law required them to do so unless they could articulate some reason to believe that it's more likely than not that that young man would be immediately dangerous. This law takes that choice away from the officer and gives it ultimately to a judge, so that all the officer has to decide is it more likely than not that this young person has been in unlawful possession of a firearm or destruction? destructive device while in school within the last 120 days. That's the decision the law enforcement officer makes. Once that decision is made, the process proceeds without the officer having to do anything except get the young person into detention. And at that point, the release decision is made by a judge after an opportunity to gather the necessary information.
If Representative Jensen jumps in with a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is no assurance, though, that the judge might not make the same call that the officer made, is it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, that's correct. What this bill does, however, is give the judge a wait-and-see opportunity. Now, under the current law, and this has not changed either, a juvenile taken into custody for any reason, not the least, has to be brought before a judge within 36 hours. So there's a 36-hour period initially for the juvenile department, the law enforcement officials, and ultimately the court to gather some information. Under Senate Bill 344, if at that time, the time of the first appearance before the judge decides, I don't have enough here. I don't have enough to know. The judge may order an additional detention of up to 7 days. Now, that's different from current law. And during that 7-day period, the judge may, in addition to any other authority the judge has, order a mental health screening or a mental health assessment. That's different from current law, and that's something that neither the tort nor the police officer could do under current law.
Let me just ask a question. We are removing the discretion from the police officer.
That's correct.
And so they're mandated to get this before a judge who has the discretion. As I read the bill, on page 1, line 13, we have the officials, the administrator, or the employee may report the person's conduct to law enforcement agency. But as I read this, that just pertains to the 120 days previous. They are mandated from the present forward to report this to law enforcement, and then law enforcement must take it to a judge. Is that correct?
Chair Sinceri, the mandatory reporting requirement applies in two situations. One, where the juvenile currently is in unlawful possession, or when within the last 120 days the juvenile was in possession. An example would be on the last day of school in the summer, the juvenile has a firearm in his or her locker. Only the student's friends know about it. No school employee does. On the first day of school, after thinking about it, the student's friends and other folks think it's a good idea to report it to a school administrator. So that would be within 120 days, there would be a mandatory reporting requirement.
But that's not at the discretion of the administrator?
No.
And what does line 13 mean?
Line 13 means that if it's beyond 120 days before the current time.
All right, more.
In other words,
okay.
If it's more than 120 days.
Okay.
And the past experience requirement just simply is a recognition of reality, I think, and that is many, many times, if not most times, that this happens, it's not going to be observed by a teacher. There's going to be a later report by someone else after the fact.
So we're not leaving any discretion then with the teacher or the administrator. This is, in essence, is a trigger, and once this event takes place, then there is no discretion on the part of the teacher or the administrator. They must report to law enforcement.
Chair Sinceri, that's correct, provided they have those reasonable grounds, some objective, articulable basis for believing that there has been the unlawful possession or that there is now an unlawful possession.
Or those people who are concerned about local control will have a problem with this.
Well, thank you. I don't think there's a problem because it's the same statute that applies to reporting suspected child abuse. If you are required to report, and you have to do it in good faith. I mean, obviously, if it's a good faith effort to report, then there's liability, correct?
Chairman Sinceri, Representative Moore said that's correct. And I would also add, I think it's important to note that under current law, school teachers are required to make these reports to administrators. What we're doing is just making the requirement go to law enforcement and also making it mandatory. And these reports are being made, but it's filtered through a system. So the idea of having to report it is not new. The idea that it's mandatory into a law enforcement officer is new, law enforcement agency.
Is it true that there is a confidentiality that follows the child abuse reporting, mandatory reporting?
Chairman Tenseri, that's correct.
And would there be any kind of confidentiality that would follow this reporting?
Chair Tenseri, the confidentiality, there is no express confidentiality requirement in this provision in 344. There is a juvenile code record confidentiality provision. In delinquency cases, which this would be, a law violation case, it's not so broad as it is in a dependency case. In a delinquency case, the history and prognosis for the juvenile can be shared with law enforcement personnel. So this report would be obviously shared with law enforcement.
Well, you probably guess where I'm going with this, though. We've got parents out there whose children's name appear on hit lists with a child in school with a gun in their pocket. And those parents today are livid in a couple of different places in our state. And it would seem to me that confidentiality or no confidentiality, our school districts are going to have an incredible liability problem if those parents are not informed that their kids are on a hit list and they're not allowed to take those kids out of school or to make some decision about that. So I think that it would behoove this committee to resolve that one way or another. There are a growing number of people who are saying, I don't care about anything except I want to know if my child or if a teacher's name appears on a hit list and a child's got a gun, they got a right to know to get their kids out of that dangerous situation. And it's taking place presently in a couple areas in Oregon. And so I'm concerned about this, where the confidentiality follows with this.
Chairman Tenseri, as I understand the description of the situation, this would be a situation where it's a potential victim, is that correct, of the person that's in unlawful possession. Maybe I can defer to Larry Oglesby here on the record this year. Larry's the director of the Marion County Juvenile Department.
Chair Tenseri, members of the committee, Larry Oglesby with the Marion County Juvenile Department, representing the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association. I don't have the code right in front of me, but there is a provision in the record section that allows a juvenile probation officer or counselor to provide confidential information where a person's physical safety is endangered. I can find the site for you and get that back to you. But there is a provision in the code that does allow for that to occur where there is a clear and present danger for the personal safety and well-being of an individual.
Well, it might be good to cite that somewhere in here.
Thank you.
Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought that the chair was going to the confidentiality provision that's in the child abuse statute that the person who is reporting has the protection when they give the report, because I can see a scenario with someone who reported and the youngster or the family is very upset that they're even involved in it, and you can have some retaliation in this case against the teacher. And so you may want to look at the statutes that we use under the child abuse statutes to protect the confidentiality of the individual who is reporting the information of the student in this case.
Chair Tenseri, Representative Winters. I think the statute that you're referring to in the child abuse reporting law, it's in Chapter 419B, makes confidential the identity of the reporters as a matter of law, not on request. And I certainly can see situations where even a teacher in certain situations would want to remain anonymous, and we can certainly look at that.
Chair Tenseri, members of the committee, it's ORS 419A255, sub 7A, and it says basically that the information contained in reports and other materials related to the child's or youth history and prognosis, that in the professional judgment of juvenile counselor, caseworker, teacher, or detention worker to whom the information or the reports or other materials have been provided indicates a clear and immediate danger to another person or to society, shall shall be disclosed to the appropriate authority and the person or entity who is in danger from the child or youth. And it goes on to provide for indemnity for the person who makes a good faith report of that is immune from civil and criminal liability for making that report. So there is a provision in current statute.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had the same question that Representative Winters had, but wanted to carry on this a little further. It would be inadequate for me as a teacher to report to the principal. That would not relieve me from the obligation of this statute.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, that's correct. It would have to be to a law enforcement agent. And Chairman,
proceed.
Let me add too that nothing in this statute is intended to prevent an individual school or a school district from instituting a procedure for this to happen. For example, the administrator, the principal, would certainly want to know that such a report is being made. And there would be nothing in here to prevent. In fact, I think we would encourage the teacher in the presence of, for example, the principal or administrator to make this call. I mean, certainly the teacher doesn't have to go out on his or her own and keep that report quiet to himself or herself.
Can I ask a little bit different comment? In the area of probable cause, for us lay people on that, you know, one student tells me that another student has a gun in their locker. Is that probable cause? Is that sufficient for me as a teacher to have to report this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, it may be. It depends on who the student is and what the circumstances of the report are. In a recent Court of Appeals case, the report of I think it was two students, both of whom were reliable students in the teacher's estimation, that a juvenile had drugs in his or her possession was sufficient. So a lot of it, again, it's reasonable grounds. It would depend on who the students are, what the nature of the report is, and how they came to have that knowledge.
That's kind of a sticky point, and I think that puts a judgment call with the teacher then as to whether that particular source is or is not reliable.
Chairman Cinceri, Representative Jensen, the judgment call for the teacher is reasonable cause to believe, not probable cause. Reasonable cause or reasonable grounds to believe means whether it's true or not, do I have enough information to prompt a report? And I think the way the bill is structured, particularly with the immunity provision that follows, we want to encourage the reporting and discourage second guessing. In other words, the idea is if you have a reasonable ground, a reasonable suspicion, even if it turns out later for there to be an innocent explanation, the policy expressed here is to make the report. Let law enforcement take the investigation forward. There is a
more sense.
Well, thank you. I think in the real world, what happens is a teacher or a bus driver or a custodian, if they suspect something in a locker, would go to the principal. The principal then has the authority to open the locker to find out. So the teacher, that would be the natural next step to take. And if indeed there was something, then I'm sure what would happen is the employee, along with the principal, would report that to the law enforcement. But I don't see this putting any school employee at risk in reporting. You simply follow the normal channels of reporting to the principal, whose job it is. And it's been established that a locker is not you don't have a right to privacy in a school locker. You know, they can go do a locker check, which they've done at different times, looking for library books. So the procedures are pretty well, I think, in place to allow this to happen.
Mr. Chair, trunk of the car instead of the locker, then. Still on the school. still in school?
I think what would happen, the principal would call the police would come down and make that decision, and I think that's, the employee would always go to the principal. I mean, as a matter of course, that's what they're supposed to do, and then the police would be called in, and then their probable cause to open it, that would be their decision.
Proceed.
Chair Sinceri, Representative Jensen, again, the bill would not change the substantive law in that area. If it was lawful before to have that fund, it would be lawful now. Again, though, I think, as Representative Morissette pointed out, the goal is to err on the side of making the report and to not have people sit and wonder whether, do I have enough grounds to make this report? And in most cases, it will go perhaps exactly like Representative Morissette described. It will be a group function and a group decision because of the principal's access to lockers and automobiles, and et cetera. I think I should, I want to emphasize again that the two core parts here, the two core pieces of this bill are to take the decision out of the hands of law enforcement, who has tragically demonstrated by the Kip Kinkle place situation simply did not have enough information to make the call that in retrospect they would have made. And two, to make sure that even the judge has sufficient information to make a call about whether this person should be released pending a hearing on the petition, pending a trial on the petition that alleges that this juvenile has had a firearm or a destructive device in the school.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, Larry Oglesby, representing the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association. You've received our written testimony, which is brief. Basically, you've heard much of the bill discussed here. We believe this is an appropriate response to the kind of situation that happened in Springfield. It goes far enough without going too far in terms of providing the necessary safeguards and protections. I would just like to comment a little bit on the impact of what this will what this bill would have. In many cases, in fact, probably majority of the counties, these cases already come through the system as this bill envisions. School people report, law enforcement investigates, brings them to the attention, the juvenile department makes a decision based on a different interpretation of the law that this youth does prevent a public safety risk and holds youth routinely on firearms. So to the extent that those cases continue to come through, there will be no significant impact. What it will do, however, is it will increase the reporting at the school level. It will increase the number who law enforcement bring to detention. So it's going to have some impact on detention facilities, which, as you may know, are full in many places throughout the state, overflowing. So it'll have some impact in terms of early releases of other youth to hold these youth in some cases. It'll also have some impact, fiscal impact, in smaller communities where they actually purchase beds from another county. So youth who would not have been detained prior to this law, they will incur those expenses. It's our belief, however, that the public policy issues of public safety override, and we're supportive of the legislation. Despite those things, we believe that giving the decision to the judge is appropriate. It also, in addition to that, as was mentioned earlier, provides additional time to collect additional information. When that youth shows up in detention, staff are going to do an initial intake evaluation of them. In many cases, they will be calling in a mental health worker, perhaps in the county health department, to do a further screening evaluation. So we have some information, additional information, to present to the judge when this case comes to court the next judicial day, which may be the next day or the weekend within 36 hours. Also have the opportunity to talk with parents, find out what's going on, more about this kid. So there's a richer array of information for the judge to make an appropriate decision. So for those reasons, we're supportive of this legislation.
About $500 is what it costs for that mental health assessment. Is that about right?
A mental health assessment, a psychological may cost up to $500, a full-blown psychological evaluation. A mental health assessment could be a half-hour visit with a mental health worker with that youth. So it'll be significantly less than that for just a mental health assessment or screening. There's a difference between that and a full-blown psychological evaluation.
So the dash ones that are asking for parents to be responsible, you don't have a problem with that?
Mr. Williamson may want to address the issue of whether the court can order that. Typically, I shouldn't say typically, in some counties at least, that is provided by a county worker who's already being paid. So it's, you know, an additional duty. In Multnomah County, your testimony that they have mental health workers in their facility. For youth who are in custody of an agency like SCF or OIA, who have a medical card, that could be charged. Parents who are on the health plan or private insurance. So there's a variety of mechanisms to pay for that. And it just depends on the circumstances in any given case, which of those would be employed.
Chairman Sincera, members of the committee, I think before we or you think about charging the parents for these screenings or evaluations, and the reason that I had an initial concern about it was ordinarily under the juvenile code, the parent is not responsible to do anything until and unless there's an adjudication, until and unless the juvenile is found to have done what he or she is alleged to do. And this would be a pre-adjudication screening. Secondly, to require the juvenile, for example, to pay for it may have some constitutional implications in terms of presenting evidence against himself or herself. So I think obviously it would be a fair, in the best of all possible worlds, it would be fair to do this. I think we should take some time to take a look at those two issues before adding that to the bill. That is, constitutionality of it, and then whether the juvenile court has authority to do that prior to adjudication.
Mr. Chair, Rick Hill again. You mentioned earlier the crime prevention strategy that's being talked about on this session, $30 million package. $10 million of that $30 million is earmarked for basic support services that will go directly to counties, such things as detention subsidy, shelter care. Assessment is one of those things, along with graduated sanctions. So there may be, if that comes through the Ways and Means process, there may be some assistance from the state to counties to do assessments for these kids and others.
Okay. Multnomah County DA told me this morning that would definitely come out of the court system. So as we were trying to think of some way to direct some of that money to the court to subsidize that cost.
If I could address that, Chair, and sir, members of the committee, the juvenile crime plans have all been developed in each community. Those were based on a task force in each community that looked at what the primary needs are for that juvenile justice system in that local community. And in some cases, they may have, in fact, included mental health evaluations as part of that. But there is not a funding source within those plans to be siphoned off, as it were, to the court.
Well, it's not a big impact, I would imagine. But we're getting to a place in the session where if it's got money attached to it, it's probably going to take a dive. But.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, you'll have to excuse me, and I hope the committee will bear with me, but this issue about the reporting gives me some heartburn here. And let me give an example, if I may. I'm concerned about Johnny, who has an AK-47 in the trunk of his car. It's under the criteria of being something he's not supposed to have, right? I'm told this by Jane, who, in my opinion, is a reliable student and a reliable source. I go to Principal Morissette to talk about this. That doesn't relieve me of the responsibility as a teacher or bus driver, as the case may be, doesn't relieve me of the responsibility in this statute, if we enact it, of reporting this to a police officer, doesn't?
Chair Sincera, Representative Johnson, the responsibility is yours.
That is my responsibility, regardless of what the principal does.
That's correct.
Okay. And I recognize that we generally work together but I'm interested in where the person. Now, the other curveball that comes in here, Jane tells me this, and I make a value judgment that I know Jane and Johnny have been going together, and he's just broken off with her in a relationship. And so I make a value judgment that this is an unreliable source. It turns out that it's that I'm wrong in my judgment, and there's a disaster that happens. What's my liability?
Chair Sincera, Representative Jensen, the statute does not require that you make a right decision. What the statute requires is that if you have reasonable grounds to make the report, that you make it. Under the scenario that you just described, it's not entirely clear that you would have reasonable grounds without further examination of that situation. In other words, just the fact that after the fact it turned out that she was correct doesn't mean that you, at that time, had reasonable grounds to make that decision.
When I get sued for this, I'm thankful that I'm an OEA member with $1 million liability policy.
Yeah, you probably get a chance to explain that in court.
But again, Chair Sinceri, if I may, I think that's exactly the situation where it would be more than you involved in making some further inquiry, because I think at that point a good argument could be made that you didn't at that point have reasonable grounds. And I think the same thing comes up in, for example, now in child abuse reporting, where the traditional story about the parents who are getting a divorce or somebody's mad at somebody else and so there's a report made. I think our experience is that that's not usually the case, but sometimes it is. We're faced with that problem in those circumstances anyway. So I think you're not just stuck with that information.
Okay, I understand. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for indulging.
No problem. Wilma Wells and Paul Snyder.
My comments will be brief. Chair Sinceri and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. I am Wilma Willis. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. And since the part of this bill that affects us is really Section 1, I do have one suggestion to make. Having in the past been a school administrator myself and reported child abuse to Children's Services, and then later had the wonderful experience of having the parent call me and give me a real pressing them down for having reported what I believed was obviously child abuse, I urged the committee to include the confidentiality of the name of the person reporting in this bill. Some of those violent children also have violent parents. And I think it would be a good protection for school people. Thank you.
Didn't we have an incident a year ago where the parent brought a shotgun to school and put some holes in the wall in Portland? Did that happen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. But we have no position on Senate Bill 344, although certainly a need to address the issues that this bill seeks to address. I just wanted to discuss briefly some issues that Mr. Oglesby alluded to, and that is the matter of cost. There is a provision that would require the reporting to occur. That's not the one that concerns us. It's the one that there's a provision that requires the law enforcement agency to investigate. Upon completion of the investigation, if the law enforcement officer determines that there's probable cause to believe that juvenile falls within these categories, then that officer must take the child into custody, and then the detention facility must take the child into detention pending the work of the court. After that, there is the provision that if the court chooses to order a mental health evaluation, then that would occur. There is a provision in the Constitution now that was known last session as Ballot Measure 30, and it's a provision that says that if the Legislative Assembly would require local governments to conduct some activity that they didn't have to conduct before, that the legislature would then pay the cost of that or provide for some other funding mechanism to accomplish it, or ask the legislature by a three-fifths vote. My sense is, now there are exceptions to this, and one of them has to do with criminal law. I'm not sure whether this would fall within or without that exception. But I think the piece, as long as, Mr. Chair, as you've indicated a couple of times in the hearing today, that this would be a cost for the courts to bear, and that would not be an issue for the middle assessment for counties. And that's the one clear piece, from my view, that would apply within the prospects of provisions of Measure 30. The others are a little bit more gray. So I just wanted to alert the committee to that fact. As I said, we don't have a position on this floor. But that measure would apply regardless of whether or not you knew it.
Questions? Thank you. Anybody else who wanted to testify on 344? Trish? Bozak? Does the OEA have anything to say on this bill? Lori? Okay. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3444. Anybody else?
Well, I'm curious about, are we going to take a look at the Dash 1 Amendment? Are we looking at putting the immunity clause or the confidentiality clause? I mean, are we going to...
We probably will bring this back by, I'm thinking, Monday. There's some more amendments that are being drafted for this. This will not get by the committee at all.
Mr. Chair.
President Jensen.
Was the chair of the staff going to draft an amendment on the confidentiality for the reporter? Or did you want one of us to...
Actually, we are going to do that. We've got the citation and not for the confidentiality. So that will be part of it. The Multnomah County DA has got some things he's interested in for this as well. Okay, let's go into a work session on House Bill 2683. Is there anyone that's signed up to testify on House Bill 2683? Why don't you give us kind of an update on this one?
You see in your packet today two different staff measure summaries on this. The one that reflects our action on the 26th of April when we passed out 2683. We have it again with a Dash 7 amendment, which I've given you a brief summary of on a separate sheet. The effect of the Dash 7 amendments would be to limit the effect of the law to just one school district, namely the Lebanon School District, and then to sunset the law on the 1st of January 2006.
Mr. Carlson? Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Carlson. I'm with Iron Workers Local 29. Bob Shiprack was going to testify on this, but he had a 245 commitment, and I just wanted to say a few words. I haven't seen the amendments to this bill, but understand that it has to do with prevailing wage, and the voters in every county in the last election voted to maintain prevailing wage in the state of Oregon. This bill circumvents what people in every county in the state of Oregon said they wanted. I understand that it's difficult sometimes to come up with funds to build schools in certain communities, but I don't think that the working people should be penalized for the lack of a bonding pass. That's all I have. Thanks.
Any questions? Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to make sure, you said you hadn't seen the Dash 7s. What the Dash 7s do is to limit the bill to only one school district in the state. I didn't know if you had that information or not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, I understand that it's for one school district, but that one school district and that one school they may build, or however many schools they may build, are going to employ a lot of people, and those people are going to be expected to work at less than the prevailing rate.
And the prevailing rate is set up through a survey, an annual survey put on by the Bureau of Labor and Industry. For the prevailed rate in each region, I think it's broke down into 13 regions. So whatever that prevailed rate is, we're against anything that'd be less than that.
Okay, committee, we are in work session, and I guess what's before us is to either adopt S7s and repass the bill or no motion at all.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Close.
I would move the dash 7 amendments into House Bill 2683.
Representative Close moves the dash 7 amendments into House Bill 2683. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? Without objection, adopt the dash 7. Representative Close.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2683A as amended to the House floor with a due pass.
Representative Close moves House Bill 2683 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be voting against this. I voted for the dash 7s because I think it is important to make that bill better just on the off chance that it could get out of there. But I have two issues. Number one, as our witness so articulated so well, I think that we should not be doing this. And secondly, unless there are some reasons that I didn't hear before, I think we discussed earlier that this can be done without this legislation, and to do it for one school district, I'm really unclear as to what benefit that has if they can do it anyway, and I think we had testimony earlier that it can be done without the law.
Further discussion, Representative Winters.
I gave the courtesy of both the last time because I share the same concerns that this is, we can do it under current law. And I don't know why we need this bill. And I do have a concern if it's going around some particular issue that we deal with the issue that it's going around.
Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Beck. Representative Close.
Aye.
Representative Hobson.
No.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Knope.
Aye.
Representative Morissette.
No.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Representative Winters?
I'll give a courtesy to give it to the floor.
Kirsten Terry?
Votes aye. Motion is adopted, and Representative Kroc will carry the bill. And as it gets to all before the committee, we are adjourned.